Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present BBC investigative reporter Greg Pallast, who discusses the history of America's relationship with Saddam Hussein and the political repercussions of his capture both in Iraq and in the U.S. Rania Masri of the Institute for Southern Studies, who examines the charges of war profiteering leveled against Halliburton and other companies with close ties to the Bush administration. And Nick Neihardt, Executive Director of Public Campaign, who assesses the recent Supreme Court decision upholding key provisions of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law banning political soft money. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories. Just weeks before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, Joe Albaugh, George W. Bush's 2000 campaign manager, quit his job as director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency to form the lobbying firm New Bridges Strategies, with the aim of linking business executives with power brokers in Iraq and the Bush administration. Already, the well-connected firm has clients hoping to sell Iraq everything from new phone lines to catering services. According to Mother Jones magazine, powerful lobbyists along K Street are looking for ways to win a piece of the hundreds of billions of dollars being dedicated to Iraqi reconstruction efforts. In recent months, Clinton-era Pentagon chief William Cohen has promoted himself as an expert on Iraqi reconstruction and set up a firm with his former deputy, Paul R.S. Gebhard. They have already landed an $80 million contract for providing security for Iraqi oil fields. Former congressional leaders Democrat George Mitchell and Republican Dick Armey, partners in the lobbying firm Piper Rudnick, have formed an Iraqi task force to land big corporate clients. Already, General Motors has signed on to the project. Other top former officials, like retired General Anthony Zinni, who ran the Pentagon Central Command during the Clinton years, are also looking for Iraqi contracts and joining lobbying firms. The mystery of what happened to Charles Horman, a freelance American journalist who was killed days after the 1973 Chilean coup led by General Augusto Pinochet, may be solved. In 1982, the search for Horman's body by his wife Joyce and father Ed was the story upon which the Oscar-winning film Missing was based. The case has long been clouded in intrigue with the charge that a CIA officer was present at Horman's interrogation by Chilean intelligence agents. According to the Knight Ridder News Service, a special Chilean court in early December indicted Rafael Agustin Gonzalez Verdugo, a former Chilean interrogator who in 1976 told Western journalists that an American was present during Horman's questioning when the order to kill the journalist was given. Horman was allegedly killed, Gonzalez remarked nearly 30 years ago, because he knew too much about the U.S. role in the Pinochet coup. A declassified 1976 U.S. State Department memo obtained by researcher Peter Kornbluh confirmed that Gonzalez had CIA ties and that U.S. intelligence may have played an unfortunate part in Horman's death. In a December interview with Knight Ridder, Kornbluh observed, "If Gonzalez, under legal pressure, spills the beans on who gave the orders and who fired the shots, then we will have arrived at justice for Charles Horman." In May 2002, then-newly elected Costa Rican President Abel Pacheco shocked onlookers during his inaugural speech when he proclaimed that the Central American nation would not be an oil enclave or a land of open pit mining. Pacheco promised new constitutional protections to ban resource extractive activities. According to the New Internationalist magazine, the speech came as a blow to Harkin Energy, the Texas oil driller with strong ties to President George Bush. In the late 1990s, Harkin had won an oil concession in southern Costa Rica, a pristine region near several wilderness areas. For 3 years, a powerful coalition of environmentalists, community activists, unions, and native peoples mobilized against Harkin Energy. Eco-activists are worried about the impact of the Central American Free Trade Agreement now under negotiation. Although Costa Rican President Pacheco pledged to defend the environment, this commitment could be undermined by provisions in free trade treaties that allow corporations to sue localities over environmental laws, claiming they interfere with ongoing business operations and corporate profits. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The U.S. capture of Saddam Hussein, found in an underground hiding place near his hometown of Tikrit, was met with jubilation in Washington and celebratory gunfire on many streets in Iraq, owing to the long list of crimes committed by the deposed dictator. The apprehension of the man who ruled Iraq for 25 years ends a 9-month American effort to kill or capture Saddam that began shortly after President Bush launched the U.S.-led war last March. Mr. Bush, very much aware of the controversy surrounding his premature declaration of a U.S. victory in Iraq last May, was more cautious about the effect Saddam Hussein's capture would have on insurgents attacking U.S. occupation forces. In the hours immediately after American troops took Hussein prisoner, guerrilla fighters launched 3 suicide bomb attacks, killing 24 Iraqi police officers working with occupation forces. The White House signaled that Saddam Hussein would likely face the death penalty in a war crimes trial organized by their hand-picked governing council in Iraq, rather than a United Nations-run tribunal. Critics expressed concern that such a proceeding would be viewed as a show trial with little legitimacy and would likely ignore questions about U.S. support for Saddam Hussein before the 1991 Persian Gulf War. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with BBC investigative reporter Greg Pallast, who discusses the history of America's relationship with Hussein and the political repercussions of his capture both in Iraq and in the U.S.
One of the most stunning things to me is when Paul Bremer came out and said the people of Iraq have suffered for decades, that he has threatened their neighbors, that he has been a cruel and vicious dictator for decades. Well, we should remember that he was our dictator for decades under U.S. state sponsorship. In 1979 is when Saddam came to power with the blessing and probable help of the United States government. Iraq was a kind of Soviet puppet until Saddam came to power and cuddled up to the USA in the Cold War. And then, in 1980, he invaded Iran with the encouragement and ultimately the arms of the United States. In fact, we effectively came in on his side. American warplanes and warships bombed Iranian oil platforms in the Persian Gulf. And in addition, we broke the back of the Iranian embargo of Saddam's ports back in the 80s and tipped the war to Saddam. In fact, this man who is the butcher of Baghdad, in 1982, Ronald Reagan removed Saddam from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. It was Reagan who said, this guy is fighting terrorism, he is not a terrorist, because basically he was supporting our terrorists. You know, in 1984... the U.S. Commerce Department issued an export license for aflatoxin, which is a deadly biological weapon. I'm giving you this history because, you know, Scott, I'll tell you why. Because Americans are trained to amnesia. They want you to forget. They want you to jump up and cheer and you know, march around the living room waving flags that we've got Saddam. Well, we put him there, so of course, you know, if we hired him, I guess we can fire him, right? So it was James Baker, who is Secretary of State, told Ambassador April Gillespie on July 25th of 1990, when Saddam Hussein said, I'm going to take action against Kuwait for stealing my nation's oil. And Gillespie said that Baker had emphasized that there was no concern of the U.S. government over Arab-Arab conflicts and that the interests of Kuwait were not the interests of the United States. And every diplomat on the planet took that as the okay for Saddam to invade Kuwait. And then a week later, we whipped around and said, hey, wait a minute, he went too far. See, he was only being given the go-ahead to enter Kuwait's oil fields. In fact, he went all the way to Kuwait City, which endangered our good buddies, the Saudis. So you have to understand, we put that guy there, and now we're pulling him out.
The White House has indicated that any trial of Saddam Hussein will take place in Iraq under U.S. occupation and through the Iraqi Governing Council installed by the U.S. rather than through the United Nations or international law. What are some of your concerns about the way this looks like it'll go for any Saddam Hussein trial?
I really would love to have Saddam on a witness stand. Let's hear this guy talk about his years on the Bush and James Baker payroll. Remember, we did support him. In fact, Saudi Arabia is looking, by the way, to receive another $39 billion from Iraq, which is why Jim Baker was put in charge of that debt. He's basically going in to make sure that the Iraqi people get squeezed for all that money sent over by the Saudis. But I think that a trial is very important, and the reason that they're having the puppet government control the trial is that they don't want anyone without strings attached to let Saddam run his mouth and basically spill the beans about who really backed him. It's not a question of punishing Saddam. You can never punish this guy enough for the blood he spilled. But what we need from him is the information, because he himself is a puppet. We need to know who Mr. Big is. So God knows what they're going to do for this little show trial, but I think what we're not going to get is any type of real information about the years of terror imposed on the Iraqi people and the Kurdish people by Saddam at our behest and with American taxpayer subsidy.
You think there's any hope that Saddam's capture will hasten the collapse of the insurgency and difficult times for the U.S. military in Iraq?
You saw that guy. I mean, did you see a guy, you know, running an international subterranean network, or did you see a guy babbling to himself in his beard looking like the Unabomber on Thorazine? Saddam Hussein was not running any insurgency. We don't know who these guys are, but they're operating with impunity in and out of Iraq. And you can capture Saddam, and you can shave his beard, and you can hang him upside down, and you can put him on a show trial. And that doesn't make either our troops in Iraq safer or Americans safer either. Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with September 11th. An evil rat he was. But September 11th was not his gig. And the perps are out there running around free. Osama is still out there, and we ain't close to him, and there's many Osamas out there, even if we got that one.
That was Greg Palast, BBC investigative reporter and author of the book The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Read his columns online at www.gregpalast.com. Not long after the White House announced a new policy to exclude nations that oppose the U.S. invasion of Iraq from being eligible to receive lucrative contracts for reconstruction projects in that war-ravaged land, reports surfaced that a favored administration company had overcharged U.S. taxpayers millions of dollars. A Pentagon audit has found that a subsidiary of the Halliburton Company, once headed by Vice President Dick Cheney, had overcharged the government an estimated $61 million for gasoline delivered to Iraq under a controversial no-bid contract. Although the Pentagon maintains that Halliburton didn't profit from the overcharge, but paid too much to a subcontractor, questions have surfaced about the company's inflated cost estimates submitted for other services to the military. While President Bush says he expects Halliburton to repay any money found to have been overcharged, administration critics such as Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman of California have called for a top-to-bottom review of all contracts awarded to companies doing business with the Pentagon in Iraq. Media attention focused on Halliburton's alleged impropriety was driven off the front page of newspapers after the surprise capture of Saddam Hussein. But the company's handling of U.S. contracts, potentially worth more than $15 billion, remains a concern for the Pentagon and many in Congress. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rania Masri, director of the Institute for Southern Studies, who examines the charges of war profiteering leveled against Halliburton, Bechtel, and other companies with close ties to the Bush administration.
Well, there's two aspects of the overcharging. Halliburton, there's clear evidence that it overcharged U.S. taxpayers with regards to importing gasoline. It was importing gasoline double the cost that it was taking a Kuwaiti company and a Pentagon company to import the same gasoline along the same roads. And Halliburton was importing it for double the cost. So basically, the overcharge for U.S. taxpayers was $61 million. Now, what's interesting is while the Pentagon was conducting this audit on Halliburton, an audit that was forced by the Pentagon because of uproar in Congress, in the process of conducting this audit, they found that Halliburton was attempting to overcharge in another area. Halliburton was attempting to overcharge taxpayers $67 million in dining services for the U.S. military, where they applied for a certain amount of money. They got that, but then they gave the subcontractor $67 million less than they had estimated the cost to be to the Pentagon. So here we have one confirmed overcharge and another attempted overcharge. And what's extremely interesting is that just this past Monday, we have the U.S. military saying that Halliburton last week was allocated another $222 million at the same time as the Pentagon audit found that the firm has overbilled for services.
Explain to our listeners, if you would, how Halliburton came to be the White House and the Pentagon's favorite company to do reconstruction projects in the oil sector and general services for the U.S. military in Iraq. Is it because, as the White House says, that they are one of the very few companies qualified and competent to do this kind of work? Or is it really because there's a sweetheart relationship going back many decades?
Both, in the sense that the Pentagon really likes to give an extremely large contract to one corporation. So if we're going to do that, that would really narrow the field for the number of corporations that can do all the work. So in that aspect, yes, one can argue, well, Halliburton's the only one out there that can do this work. But there's no reason why we need to give all this work to just one corporation. And we have seen that Halliburton's contracts have increased with the importance of Dick Cheney in Congress. I mean, we saw just last year Halliburton was losing money. And with the Iraq reconstruction contracts, Halliburton gained money. And what's also interesting to point out is that recently when Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton, that was when Halliburton had a massive increase in offshore tax haven subsidiaries and therefore paying less taxes while it is getting more taxpayer money to do its work.
Now, what's the history of Halliburton when it comes to overcharging the Pentagon or other U.S. government agencies in the past? Is there a track record that we can look at to indicate this is not some anomaly but a pattern of behavior?
Yes, this is not the first time that Halliburton's KBR subsidiary has been accused of cost overruns on a government contract.
KBR is Kellogg Brown and Root,
Kellogg,
a subsidiary.
Brown and Root, I'm sorry.
In fact, they were the ones that catered the Thanksgiving dinner that President Bush dropped in on at the Baghdad airport, right?
Yes, and they may have been the ones that supplied the fake turkey for President Bush to walk around with, which says a lot about their work. But in September 2000, the General Accounting Office found that the U.S. Army had not taken appropriate steps to limit the $2.2 billion cost KBR charged for logistic and engineering support for the Balkans. So here we have one example. According to that report, Army officials, quote, frequently have simply accepted the level of services the contractor provided without questioning whether they could be provided more efficiently or less frequently at lower cost. So we also have to point out, well, most likely they did overcharge in the Balkans. Most likely they've overcharged before, but there simply hasn't been that kind of competitiveness, that kind of even accountability and transparency into contracts that the government has given to Halliburton. And we can't deny the influence of Dick Cheney, who continues to be on Halliburton's payroll in the sense that he gets a deferred salary of more than $140,000. And since the beginning that Dick Cheney has been vice president, Halliburton has earned $2 billion so far from these contracts.
Is there anybody in Congress who's demanding an accounting here of what Halliburton's relationship is with the White House and demanding that criminal prosecution or civil prosecution be actually looked into for Halliburton's conduct?
Well, there was an attempt during the $87 billion supplemental money that was given to the military. There was an attempt by several Democratic representatives in the House not to allow contracts to Halliburton so long as Halliburton is paying Dick Cheney and other members of the administration, that money be stopped one way or another. And that amendment failed. But the fact that that amendment was tried shows a lot. To my knowledge, there is no other amendment or bill or any kind of other real action being done in Congress to press for real penalties. I agree with them that this isn't the time to be pressing for that because, first, we at least need to make it illegal to conduct war profiteering. We need to make it illegal to have profiteering and fraud relating to military action and reconstruction efforts in Iraq. And thus far, it's not really prohibited. The good news is there is a bill in the Senate and a bill in the House that is calling for the prohibition of war profiteering. And that's Senate Bill 1813, sponsored by Senator Leahy from Vermont. And again, that's Senate Bill 1813. In the House, it's House Bill 3673 that's sponsored by Representative Emanuel, who's a Democrat from Illinois. So the House bill is 3673, the Senate bill is 1813, and I really think it's very important for all of us to be supporting these bills, and if we get these bills to pass in Congress, then we will have a greater foundation to push for more penalties and to push for, real penalties. But so long as this bill doesn't pass, we don't really stand much of a chance to push for penalties for overcharging and penalties for Halliburton.
That was Rania Masri, director of the Institute for Southern Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 919-419-8311 or visit their website at www.southernstudies.org. On December 10th, the U.S. Supreme Court voted 5-4 to uphold all major provisions of the bipartisan campaign reform law, originally sponsored by Senators John McCain, Republican of Arizona, and Russell Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin. The law, which bans so-called soft money raised by political parties as opposed to individual candidates, has been in effect for a year while appeals made their way through the courts. Opponents of the law formed an unusual coalition that included both the National Rifle Association and the American Civil Liberties Union. They claimed that raising and spending unlimited amounts of cash should be protected as a form of free speech, but the courts disagreed. Still perfectly legal are so-called hard money contributions, those made directly to candidates. In fact, the McCain-Feingold Act raised the limits on allowable hard money donations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Nick Neihardt, Executive Director of Public Campaign, an organization dedicated to reducing the influence of private money on electoral politics. He says that while the Supreme Court decision is a limited victory, it's a victory nonetheless. Neihardt describes his group's efforts for more comprehensive reforms, including the establishment of a publicly funded clean money campaign finance system for candidates competing at the state level.
I think it was a victory in two ways. First, the courts actually upheld the provisions of the law, which means that political parties will no longer be able to raise money on an unregulated basis, that is, in unlimited contributions. And there are also some restrictions on what outside groups can do in the course of elections. But I think even more important than that, the court showed that it was willing to react to political reality and curb money and the role of money in politics as it impacts elections year in and year out. In other words, they didn't treat the Constitution as a static document, but said we need to look at the current situation and say that Congress has the right to write laws that will improve our democracy. And that, I think, in the long run, is the most important part of this decision.
Where do we stand, though, in the country? Even though this law was upheld, it basically regulated soft money, and I know that what's called hard money contributions, their level was raised.
I mean, there are a couple things. First, most of the money in the system is hard money, not soft money. Better than 80%, in fact, is the hard money. And the limits on what an individual can give were increased. In other words, Bush's raising of probably close to $200 million for his own campaign this year would have been much harder to do were he subject to the old $1,000 limits. They doubled the limits. They also doubled some aggregate limits. In other words, what a person can give as a whole is limited, and those limits went up too. In other words, I can give some money to a Senate candidate, some money to someone running for Congress, some money to the presidency. Well, there's an overall cap on what an individual can give, and that cap was also raised. So the hard money playing field got tilted even more against ordinary people who can't afford to make a $1,000 or $2,000 contribution and probably can't afford to make a $100 contribution. On the soft money side, it really curtails the political parties being in the soft money business, raising that money and spending it. On the other hand, all that money can still flow into other entities and be spent to influence elections. So we're going to see a diversion. It's not really a soft money ban. It's a soft money diversion, and that money will now go to issue groups that are set up under the tax code to fit certain requirements, and those issue groups will wind up being able to spend the money in much the same way that the party spent it before. I think the court's ruling now allows reformers to proceed with some confidence to enact even bigger reforms.
Is there any interest or has there been any activity in Congress up to now to limit hard money, so-called hard money contributions? And what do you think it would take to pass something like that?
It's a tough thing to get through Congress. On the other hand, it's one of the things that the public most easily understands. And I've seen polling on this for years. One of the kinds of reforms that is most popular is to say, shall we reduce campaign contribution limits from $2,000 to $500 to $100? If we were simply to have a referendum, that would pass easily. So I think there's the potential for organizing at the grassroots to put additional pressure on Congress. But ultimately, I think the real solution has to be public financing, which is more complicated to understand, but it does a much better job of solving the problem. And there are systems up and running now in five states. They've been passed and are on the books in five states. fully up and running in two states that do just that, permit candidates to run without having to raise any private money at all. It simply allows them to meet some qualifying thresholds and then get a flat grant of public financing for their elections. We think that the more candidates have to rely on private financing, the more they're indebted to all kinds of special interests that have an interest in policy. And that's not good for policy. It's not good for democracy. It's not good for the participation of ordinary citizens. We just released a study called The Color of Money, which looks at the distribution of campaign contributions geographically and specifically looks at census data about race and ethnicity. The report demonstrates very, very clearly that when you base a system on large and medium-sized private contributions, you put an institutional bias against Latino communities and African-American communities into the system. And certainly that's the last thing we want if we want to have an inclusive democracy. So our view is private fundraising brings all sorts of perils. Let's switch to a very simple system of public financing as works right now in Maine and Arizona.
Do you see any chance of getting public financing through the Congress?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a very good chance over the next several years that we can at least restore presidential public financing to the point where you don't need to get elected to the presidency by selling policy to everybody with an interest in policy at the U.S. Capitol.
That was Nick Neihardt, executive director with Public Campaign. For more information, call the group at area code 202-293-0222 or visit their website at www.publiccampaign.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.